染めない夢
What is up with everybody? You're listening to Otaku Spirit Anime Cast. My name is Andrew, and I'm joined here with Chris.
Yo.
And today's episode is our summer 2022 anime season reviews, part 2 of 3. We have a lot of really high caliber titles in this particular one. Probably a little bit too much weighted on part 2, but that's fine. There's still a lot of really great stuff coming in the third parter. But for this one, we have Ayumu. When will Ayumu make his move? Prima Doll, Licorice Recoil, Engage Kiss, Black Summoner, Awashi, Parallel World Pharmacy, Illuminous Witches, Classroom of the Elite, Second Season, Orient Part 2, Overlord, Season 4, and Odd Taxi in the Woods. There won't be too much for the Odd Taxi one. I just wanted to put my thoughts into a podcast format of some sort for our podcast-only listeners so they get to hear my thoughts on that. I don't like to keep things from our podcast listeners, even though I do a lot of stuff on YouTube that I'm not going to convert to somebody asked me at some point, like, can you convert all of your YouTube videos to podcast form? I'm like, for one, that would be like way too much work, like way too much work. And two, that would completely flood the feed with a lot of stuff that technically needs a visual perspective and stuff. So you can use YouTube to listen to the videos. I'd appreciate it and get the ads there and support the channel. I appreciate it. Or share it out. It's good. Anyways, let's get into this one, because we have a lot to go through, and I'm sure, like, at least 2, maybe 3 of them is going to be a lot of discussion, so let's kick things off with, when will Ayumu make his move, or Sore Domo Ayumu wa Yose Takeru. This one was streaming on High Dive, done by Studio Silverlink. The source is a manga. Genres are comedy, romance, slice of life. Director was Mirai Minato, who did Jassy-sama Will Not Be Defeated, Fate Collide, Liner Prisma, Ilya, and Masamune-kun's Revenge. And of course, the creator behind the original source material is Shoichiro Yamamoto, who did Teasing Master Takagi-san and Konichi Tsubaki. So definitely a familiar style.
Yes.
Forehead girls.
Mm-hmm. Forehead girls.
Forehead girls, I think, is what everybody says. It's the forehead girls. But yes, very familiar design. And yeah, series composition by Hitomi Mueno, who did Snow White with Red Hair, Flying Witch, and many other really fantastic titles. So, yeah, this one opens up with Ayumu, who is going to his shogi club with his senpai, Urushi. And we find out really quickly, as they're the only two people in this not-formed club yet. It's not an actual club, but it's a club. It's just not official yet, because they need, like, 5 members. But he goes to this club on a regular basis to, you know, play shogi with Urushi. And we find out that Ayumu really, really likes Urushi, but he won't confess his love to her until he defeats her in shogi. And of course, she's really good at shogi, so unless she gives some sort of handicap, he never beats her. And if she does give him a handicap, he doesn't feel like that's a defeat or that he didn't win. So you kind of have him strategizing to figure out how he's going to be able to defeat her. At the same time, he's very open about her. Like, he does say very often that, you know, she's cute, that he likes being around her and all this kind of stuff. And she's on the opposite end going, he says all this stuff, but he doesn't want to say that he loves me. So why is he not doing that? And so she's obviously trying to push him to confess. While at the same time, we all know that he's not going to until he beats her. So, and we meet other characters like Ayumu used to be in the Kendo Club, but he left the Kendo Club to join Urushi's club because he wanted to be with her. So we do meet his other member of the Kendo club, which is Takeru. He is often seen at the library hanging out with Sakurako, who he obviously really likes. And then we have Maki, who knows that Urushi and Ayumu are a thing, so she's constantly trying to push them. Later on, you meet a Kohai, Rin, who comes into the picture, who knows Ayumu from the past, too. So, yeah. Your thoughts on when will Ayumu make his move?
If there was any doubt, of course. I absolutely love this show. I do like the fact that in a lot of ways, this is kind of the opposite of Teasing Master Takagi-san. It's not exactly a word-for-word opposite. I mean, it's just nice to see Ayumu throws Urushi off. And that's kind of the opposite of Takagi-san, where Takagi would mess with... why can I think of his name at the moment?
Oh, the boy?
Yeah, throws him off in a lot of cases. And that was a lot of the humor. For sure, this is not the centralized theme of this show. It's not about teasing back and forth. It's just that the dynamics are kind of flipped in a lot of ways. So this makes it a lot of fun to watch in this case, where she's constantly in her head going, why can't I get him to say how he really feels? And you do know that he does have these feelings, and she does kind of get the idea, so it's not like she's completely oblivious to him. Like Andrew had said, the whole thing is he refuses to actually confess until he defeats her, and they at that point would be on the same level, because that's how he feels in the whole Kendo thing. And then we get a little bit more of a understanding of the dynamic a little bit later in the show for those of you who have watched. Yes, there is that aspect. So I do like that. But in a lot of ways, this is one of those shows where you feel like you get to a point and at the same time, you're not getting that. So it's a lot of fun, and I think it's adorable. I will probably always love these kind of puppy love type shows, and they're always going to hit those notes. So yeah, love it.
I think that's where I get from going from Teasing Master Takagi-san to this one, is that it's like just a step up. So they're a little bit more mature. We're not talking about like middle school, very juvenile type of love here. This is kind of, they both know what they're looking at. It isn't like with Teasing Master Takagi-san, where he's always going, you know, she's obviously teasing me. She obviously hates my guts. Why is she keep doing this? And on the other end, it's obviously a girl who's matured more, and she's going, I really like this guy, and I just want to be around him, and I love seeing him react to me. I want that attention. Whereas this one is literally, both sides know. It's just Ayumu can't specifically say. That's really the whole shtick. And so it does kind of play out that way, which I do find really adorable. And yes, I agree, seeing the Urushi faces, this is literally Urushi faces the anime. It's how many times can you see Urushi gets blush or panic or whatever? That's literally 90% of the show is Urushi faces. And that's where I kind of get where a lot of the show just didn't really, it works for what it's doing, which is, again, Urushi faces, but at the same time, it's kind of repetitive in that regard, which you technically got with Teasing Master Takagi-san, but I think that Teasing Master Takagi-san had some really good writing. It was more about, Teasing Master Takagi-san was more about what kind of clever thing will Takagi do to throw him off? What is she going to trick him with this time? And there was a clever aspect to that. This one is more about kind of very, more slice of life, but throw in the throw offs every now and then. It was just kind of playing shogi together and then throw in something. It's about going out to the park and then doing something at the same time. It was always kind of, rather than it be a tricking aspect, it was just more about existing aspect. And for that reason, a lot of it was kind of shrug, like, okay, cool, I got another Urushi face, but what else kind of thing. I think I had more fun out of Sakurako and Takeru on the side of the library than anything, because that was more of a, they were doing things on the side, acknowledging what Ayumu and Urushi's relationship is, and at the same time, they had some quirks to it, like the fact that Sakurako can really easily hypnotize Takeru, or they're wanting to surprise Urushi and Ayumu in the haunted house, and so they creep up inside of this box together, and of course that doki dokis fly everywhere. It was cute in that regard. But yeah, it was a great show. I enjoyed it. Not a great show. It was a good show. I enjoyed it. Again, a lot of cute faces, a lot of reactions. I really do like how forward Ayumu is. Again, he won't say specifically that he loves her, but he says pretty much everything else. So whenever, like, in the situation of the typical rain scenario and him having an umbrella, he's just super happy. And he's like, super completely transparent about it. So Urushi obviously knows that he's happy about it. You kind of see that little, you know, yes kind of thing with his arm. Like, yes, I can do this kind of thing, which is always fun. So they're a really cute little couple. Enjoyed watching their time together. And again, it's just kind of everything but straight out saying it. And so it's kind of refreshing in that regard. So, and yes, more forehead girls. I love the character designs of this artist for sure. So that's when will Ayumu make his move. Check that out if you're looking for a more advanced, but not quite there romance, I guess is the best way to put it. But yeah. Prima Doll. This one streamed on High Dive, ran for 12 episodes. Studio is Bibbury Studio, Animation Studio. Source is a multimedia project. The genres are comedy, drama, slice of life. The creator behind this series is Key. Yes, Key. The creators of Clonod, Air TV, all of those tragic girlfriend stories. Character designs by Yui Hara, who did Kiniro. Why am I fumbling his name? Kiniro Mosaic. But yes, this is from the creators of Key, who brought you Tragic Girlfriends. This is their take on cute girls doing PTSD, pretty much. So, yeah. It opens up with this one empire, which has recently seen peace. The war is over. Everybody's happy. They're celebrating. Life is moving forward. But, of course, the tools they used in the war itself, which are these automata and these mechana, these things have to be decommissioned. So the war's over, take the weapons of war and decommission them and get rid of them. Well, one specific person who runs a cafe, Nagi Toma, who we get in a sense was a part of the war as well, he's decided that he wants to repurpose these automata and actually, you know, reformat them and recommission them to be servers at his cafe. They're very beautiful designs. I don't know why you would see them on a battlefield, but they're like these really cute girls, very colorful hair, very vibrant, beautiful kimonos, and they would essentially go out there and they would command all these mechana, these little machines that were going out and fighting. So they were kind of like a beacon to control everything. But he wants to, you know, again, reconfigure them, and now they're working at his cafe. Right from the beginning, we follow Haizakura, who is one of these automata. She wakes up in the basement of this cafe, comes to the surface, kind of looks around for a little bit, but then kind of gets shown what she's supposed to be doing, which is, you know, all these different roles in the cafe, serving, cooking food, clean dishes, all that kind of stuff. And eventually, over time, you'll learn that there is still factions out there that are trying to restir up the war. And for the most part, each episode, really getting a sense of what each of these girls, or these automata, what their experiences were in the war, what they're kind of still dealing with. The scars of the war itself is a big, crucial part of it. And then kind of just moving forward. So, did you say you didn't watch this one?
No, I didn't finish it. I got about halfway through.
Sadness. You're missing... No. You're missing out on some great key action. Well, what did you think of the first half?
Well, by the time I got into about the halfway point, you could start feeling out where the direction of the show was going to go. And it was literally, as far as I could tell, I have to agree, it pretty much felt like what they were doing was going from girl to girl, or a character who had just came into the group and kind of not necessarily solving their problems, but at least getting it to where it was tolerable, per se. And you can get that sense in the first episode or two, but it really does kind of cement itself towards the halfway point, where it literally one of the girls in the cafe, or a introduced member to the cafe, what is their problem? How are they dealing with the aftermath of that problem? And then how can they not necessarily solve it, but at least make it to where it's something that they can work with into the future. And I think that they did very, very, very well at what they were doing. I mean, it was dealing with the tragedies of war. What is how war is not necessarily a glorified or something that you should necessarily glorify. And I think they do that very well.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much what the first half is, because you have like six characters that you're going to go through with the beginning, like an introduction episode. Then you have like, you know, Katasuba gets an episode, Gekka gets an episode, Hokiboshi gets an episode, Retzel gets an episode, even Yugiri gets an episode. And then beyond that, it was like, let's start to introduce the main story, which, I mean, many people can probably guess what that's going to be. The main person that's going to be the focal point of the story. And that kind of ramps up towards the end. So you get like a good three or four episodes of one key storyline, no pun intended. And the rest of it is really just, let's hit a girl per episode. And I think the problem that I have overall with the story is that Key doesn't really work well like that. Like, I've known Key for doing at least two episodes for a character to really dig into them and really let the story they want to tell about that particular character set, and you get built up that emotion. Whereas this one's like literally, oh, hey, we got this situation to deal with. Oh, why don't you go down there with Gekka? All right, Gekka's turn. Here's Gekka's story. And then they're traveling with Gekka. And then suddenly out of nowhere, you get a little comment. Oh, Gekka's got something wrong with her. And then like the last, you know, 5 to 7 minutes is Gekka's story. And you're like, oh gosh, this is sad. Cures. And then move on. All right, Karasuba's turn. Let's go out to do something, Karasuba. All right, guess we're doing Karasuba's turn. All right, let's hang out for a little bit. And then at the last 5 minutes, Karasuba's story. It's just, you don't get that build up. You don't get that sense. You don't get to sit in the situation for very long. And I think that's where it doesn't work for Key. Now, they are impactful stories, and you're still going to cry because cute girl's crying. And you know, if you've seen Gekka cry, It's life changing. If you see Retzel cry, it hurts. I think Retzel actually got two episodes, if I remember correctly. I'm not sure.
If I remember right, it seemed like it.
But they are still sad stories, and it's obviously always going to be magnified by the fact that it's cute girls and they look cute and they're super vibrant in a very dull world. But at the same time, it could have been better. Like, it could have been so much better if they really built into these stories and really gave it a nice solid backstory, rather than try to rush through it the way that they did. So, which made it, honestly, the last story hit even harder, because you spent so much time building into that last bit of the story that when it finally does get to that, you know, the after story point, you're like, oh gosh, this is really killing me, because now I understand, because I've gotten 12 episodes to build up to the story technically. So it does still hit when it needs to hit. It's just, again, my whole point is that it could have been better. It could have been so much better, so much more impactful. The refreshing thing, really, honestly, overall for Prima Doll versus anything else that Key has done, yes, Key does have robot stories. I mean, Planetarian is a robot story. It's a human story. It's a war story as well, but it is also technically an android AI robot story. But I think that it is kind of refreshing every now and then to get a Key story where it's not about Doki Doki's childhood love, and then, oh, by the way, childhood, you know, romance dies. Like, there's a tragic girlfriend stories that they're so used to doing. It's, for once, about war. It's about the scars of war itself. And mostly, and majority, is about moving forward. It is, again, about the scars, for sure. How much this war screwed up these girls, despite the fact that they want to move forward. And it is, it's more interesting to kind of take it from perspective of a robot that is serving at this cafe that's not necessarily going to run off and leave Nagi because, Doki Doki, I found a lover on the side of the street and we want to have, you know, we want to get in a relationship. It's about robot girls that are technically very human. Now, it's interesting that they never, I don't remember them really recall them getting into what makes them so human, what makes them have so much emotions, obviously how they're designed. I don't know why you would design something to have emotions when it's supposed to go out to war. But again, story logic, we got to have girls cry. So we have to just throw in, oh yeah, by the way, there's a mechanism in them that allows them to be emotional. But it doesn't really matter too much. It does hit the points that it needs to hit and kind of developing those storylines and really driving home a lot of the stories that it's telling. And I think there's a few of them that are a lot more interesting and more emotional than others. I specifically loved Huckaboshi's story, despite that one being a pretty short one as well. It still hit. And I think a lot of it has to do with the whole silent girl thing. If you have a character that can't speak, you're going to cry.
Yeah.
And for some reason, it always hits at some point. So I particularly really love Retzel's story. Yuguri was an early one as well. And I think that was more... That one hurt more, and it does kind of replay it a lot with these characters, but essentially their master board, the main board of their systems, if it gets messed up, it has a problem retaining memories. So there's a lot of stories about the fact that they can't retain anything they have experienced, and a lot of that stuff personally hits more than I think for most people. That fact of forgetting somebody is really harsh, but once it hits. It looks very visually beautiful. Bibury Animation Studio did a really good job of the series. Really kept the characters on model. Really fantastic designs. Great music that's usually from Key. They usually manage to pull off really nostalgic feeling music that has a more, I would argue in some cases, very more amateur-esque sounding, but very, what's the best way to put it? Very childlike and more innocent kind of sounding music. So, yeah, we're not talking about like, you know... some crazy vocals, aimer stuff here. It's just kind of very, very more natural sounding stuff. So, yeah, overall, solid series. But definitely not one of Key's best series. And I think it's because a lot of these stories were very, very short. Some people can probably argue that that's better for you. Some people like shorter stories, not something that's too built into, not too melodramatic. But each their own. Yeah, Bring It All. Check that out if that sounds interesting to you. I've already seen one video they released of, speaking of multimedia project, they already released like a video of Haizakura singing the Clannad ED. So it's like, yeah, they're going to probably do that stuff. Haizakura's voice was okay. Wasn't the best, but it's fine. They're going to do music CDs, albums, and all that stuff now. Moving on, we have Licorice Recoil. This one was streaming on Crunchyroll, ran for 13 episodes, done by Studio A1 Pictures. The source is an original. The genres are action, comedy, slice of life. And the creator of this one was Asa Ura, who did Bento. And yeah, this one basically takes place in Japan. It's a very peaceful time. Everybody's happy. Everybody's living good lives. Crime rate is non-existent. It's a peaceful time in Japan. But we find out very quickly is that there is an organization known as the DA that pretty much raises orphan children to becoming what they call licorice, which are these girls that will go around and basically take out threats before they even happen. And if something does happen, like a terrorist attack or something like that, they'll go in, you know, take them out, and then this entire AI system will go out and erase any existence of any evidence that something happened. So basically the public image, they just think, you know, it was a gas leak or something like that. It wasn't anything bad. If there was any videos posted on the internet, they'll get rid of them. It's a really good cover-up system. So, yeah. Right off the bat, we follow Takina, who is working for the DA. At some point, there's this big hostage situation, and Takina just mows down all the bad guys. Despite her order, she wipes out all the bad guys with her gun. And because of that reason, she's pretty much kicked out of the DA. She's transferred to this place, this cafe known as Lico Rico, which is run by a guy named Mika, who we find out was a former member of the DA. And also working there is Chisato, who is another licorice. And even though Takina wants to go back to the DA, because again, that was her life. She was born and she was raised as an orphan to work at the DA. That's pretty much her home. She wants to go back to it. She obviously believes that it was wrong that they kicked her out. So she's working for a way to get back in the DA. At the same time, Chisato is working at her side as basically her senpai, because Chisato is a very well-known licorice, was involved with this really crazy incident that happened at this tower. The weird thing is that Chisato is non-lethal. So whenever she goes out to an incident, she's using non-lethal, whereas Takana's like, hey, we have the license to take out anybody. Why are you using non-lethal? But that's just what Chisato believes. She doesn't want to take lives. So there's a little bit of back and forth with there. Over time, you kind of see that relationship kind of build between Chisato and Takina as they do different jobs. And eventually, this crazy Kirito guy shows up and starts trying to create balance. And so, yeah. Your thoughts? I've been actually waiting for I think people are sick of hearing me talk about Licorice Recoil, honestly. I think I've done like 50 million videos, including my episode-by-episode impressions. So I think people are like, I want to hear Chris. Shut up, Andrew.
Well, I think everybody's going to be disappointed because I'm pretty much in the same boat as Andrew. I absolutely
disappointed. I hated this show.
No, I love the show. It's one of those things that as I'm listening to Andrew's talk about it, and it's like I fall so in line. I love the character artwork. I love the storyline. I love the character and diving into the characters in a lot of cases. If I had any criticisms of this show, it would literally be
Yoshi.
No. That one, actually, I agree, it is frustrating. I kind of wish and that it actually is a kind of an extension of what I was getting ready to say, is I kind of wanted the writing to be a little bit more dive a little bit more deeper into the psychology of these characters. I don't need drama over melodrama on all this. I want to explore the feelings of these characters a little bit more. I think they did fine for the amount of time that they had, considering this is technically more of an action flick type show. And so the main gist of it is to keep going with the action beats. And they did fine for the amount of time that they allotted for the drama beats. So don't get me wrong. I think that they did a fantastic job with this show. It's just, if I had a critique, it would be that I wanted more into these characters. So maybe if we do get another season, we will get that. But as it stands right now, we have what we have, and I think they did a fantastic job.
Yeah, I would argue action character show.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, there was some episodes where it was like a couple minutes of action, so it's hard to say that's an action show when there's like a couple minutes. But I agree.
It's one of those things that it's a criticism, not necessarily a flaw in the story.
But I agree with you. The side characters. There's a lot of side characters that I wish I knew more about. But at the same time, when I say character action show, it's Tisato talking a character action show.
But yeah, it's, other than that, it's a fantastic show. And I do not walk away from the show disappointed. I am very happy with what I got out of the show, especially some of the action scenes were really fantastic. Chisato is absolutely brilliant. And even some of the other characters towards the end, they got their moments where they got to really, really shine.
Mika, dude. I had this big argument for the longest time where I'm like, Mika doesn't do much. I mean, he's always kind of like the side, you know, he's the papa. He's the papa in
he's a big old papa bear.
Yeah, he's the one that's taking care of these girls and giving terrible advice to Takina as to what she should wear for underwear because she doesn't know. And the only thing he can say is boxers. But he's the papa bear, yeah. And it was like, for the longest time, it was like, he's not doing anything. And then, like, at the very end, it's like, okay, I see why he's not doing anything. We've seen like this massive development part for him, and then literally like he steals the last episode. And I'm like, really, Mika, dude, Papa Bear, Papa Bear. It was good. But no, I think my only argument really is I agree that there's they're already creating other properties around this thing. They're already doing like I think two mangas and a light novel, so it does feel like they're going to probably have more. I think one of the mangas is supposed to be more about just like, you know, the daily life at the cafe, very slice of life, fun stuff. But I really do like the idea. And I think the light novel is supposed to be they're writing the whole story out in the light novel. But I do really hope that what comes from these side things, or again, yes, technically if they do an OVA or a side project or a sequel of some sort, that they do start to get into a lot of stuff that they've only kind of scratched in. I don't feel like this story is unfinished. This feels like a really solid ending to this story. But it's obvious that they have went out of their way to hint at other groups. I mean, even at some point, they mentioned this idea of a Lily Bell. I'm not going to get to the specifics of a Lily Bell, but at some point, they show a very unique-looking Lily Bell. And so it's like, why would you show us a very unique Lily Bell unless you have plans on doing at least a movie or something like that that's going to include this Lily Bell, or if he's going to have a side project story? That's another possibility, maybe a Lily Bell manga. But they have the possibilities here. It's not that they require to be told, but there's a couple threads here that we haven't really got too much into that could possibly expand out. But for this season, for this 13 episodes, I feel like I was very satisfied with what I got. And again, sorry to anybody that has watched all my videos and my reviews to get the same stuff again. I think this writer is brilliant at writing characters, be it the script writers for, I think they have like three different script writers, be it Asa Uda and his writing. They nailed Chisato and Takana's relationship, especially early on coming into the story, having Takana be a character I typically hate in shows. She is the long black-haired idol girl that is takes everything too seriously. No fun allowed girl. The one that has a sign that always puts it down. But they nailed it. Like, I loved this girl because they nailed how they developed her character. She's very closed off at first. And then over time, Chisato shows her, here's an opportunity. I'm not going to force you to accept other things besides of what you're focused on, which is getting back to the DA and serving the DA. But I'm going to offer you a choice over here. That fountain scene was perfect. The writing, the way it was voiced, everything was perfect to show I have an option here. Give it a shot. If you don't like it, go back to what you were doing. It's fine. And then over time, slowly seeing these moments where Takana comes out. Sakana! These little moments where Takana just breaks out of that shell. And it just put a huge smile on my face. I just loved the interactions between these two characters. And I wish we had got more scenes where the two of them were fighting side by side, because those scenes were absolutely fantastic. Chisato and Takana, this is character writing right here. I cannot say enough if any writer out there wants to know how to write natural feeling bonds between two characters, that's the show. Takana and Chisato were just so well written. They feel very natural. They're so fun to be around. And then outside of that, I think the action stuff was the initial draw to the show for me. I especially loved how they played out the action scenes, because they weren't just pew-pew back and forth or punch, punch, punch. These, obviously, for the sake of explaining it better, Chisato has the ability to see, observe very well. So when she sees a gun pointed at her, she observes where the chamber's aiming towards. She sees where the finger's at, if it's on the trigger. She can see when the person's going to kind of pull the trigger, and she kind of dodges bullets that way. It's not that she has a magical ability of dodging bullets, it's that she observes and corrects herself in her positioning. And yes, it is technically still kind of a little bit in the fantasy world, but still, at least it's explained in a way that makes it more logical in a real grounded sense. But the way they use that, how they use cover fire, flanking, all that kind of stuff, each action scene was really well played out. Now, granted, later on, there was a few of them that were like, that was a little bit kind of shrug of an action scene. But overall, I really enjoyed the action scenes. They were a lot of fun. And I think adding to that whole aspect of Chisato being non-lethal, and she's like, she shoots a couple people on a staircase and they go to fall off the staircase. She runs up there and grabs them, make sure they don't fall off the staircase. Or she's on some rafters with some other guy and they both kind of fall at the same time. And she's kind of telling the guy that was just shooting at her with, lethal. She's yelling at him, hang in there, we can make it. And she's climbing at the same time. It's just a lot of fun. Like, Chisato is absolutely just basically stole the entire year for me and has gone down as one of my favorite characters. Like, Chisato, as personality-wise, how silly, how very natural-sounding her seiyuu did. Her seiyuu, it almost feels like they let her seiyuu just have creative freedom. Because sometimes whenever there's an animation point, it doesn't quite match her, the voicing that she did, because it feels like they kind of let her do what she wants to do. She feels very, very loose and very natural. Takana, I just love because I loved how her character developed. I think she's a really solid character development. But they absolutely stole the year.
This is one of those odd couples done right. I really, really like, and it's not odd couple for the sake of comedy. This is odd couple. Literally, these two characters really offset each other. Takana being this diehard, like Andrew was saying, rules
I'm
are
so
the
focused
rule.
On yeah. I'm so focused on my regimen that I don't even know what kind of underwear I should wear.
Yeah, and Chisato is this really magnetic, fun loving, just high on life type character, and the two of them paired up together really offset each other, and it makes Takana soften, and it kind of grounds Chisato. So I love how that dynamic works out in a lot of cases. So yeah.
And yeah, I like I mentioned or kind of alluded to earlier, I I think the only weak point of the entire series was probably Yoshi. He's obviously laid out pretty early on as being kind of this guy that walks into the cafe on a regular basis, and Chisato loves talking to him, and you get a really quick sense that he's going to be involved more in the story later on. And technically, the group that he works with and all that kind of stuff, I feel like that stuff could have been better explained, but they don't ruin the show. That was kind of the argument that I was making later on in the series, because there was one, I'm not going to get into what it is, there's one big, huge core point of the story that they get into at the later parts. Like, this becomes really what a lot of people focused on as being, like, the climax of the show. And I almost felt like the people that were kind of upset with how it would go one way or another, I kind of got to that point where whenever people were saying that, I'm saying, I don't think that's really the point of the show. Like, if that becomes the thing that kills or breaks the show for you, I think you missed the whole point of the entire show. Like, this is a prime example of I love the journey. Like, the journey was more than the destination. And that's what I loved about this series. That's like when Mal was posting their ratings for the series from episode one to the last episode, I'm like, it was always good. Like, it was always good. Like, from the very beginning, I was sold. The action sold me at the beginning. Character sold me at the fountain. And then I just fell in love with them at that point. So, really awesome series. I think they did a fantastic job putting this together. And I like getting many other people. I'm looking forward to seeing what else they do. And I'll probably be checking out the mangas and all that kind of stuff. Like, anything I can get at this point, I will consume. Hopefully the mangas and stuff pull off the art style. Because, yeah, I agree with you. I love the character designs. And good thing, remembered. Style. Like, this, somebody working at this studio when this was being put together has some style. Like, I love all the outfits. They go out of their way to have, in most shows, characters wear like maybe one, possibly two different outfits in the entire show. This one was all over the place, and they had all these end cards and these commercial break caps that had these fantastic outfits and different artwork for the characters that just was great. The OP had so much of it. I love all the outfits the characters have, and it really does show, like I said, somebody's got some style that works there, and I ate up every single one of those different outfits, so. Oh, yeah, Kurumi. Tama.
I'm pretty sure I looked that up, and it wasn't Tama.
It was Tama.
I'm almost positive.
Is this a problem?
I looked it up.
Icarus recoil.
I thought it was Tama, too. I'll be damned. Maybe I just looked at the wrong place. I don't know.
You think I'm crazy?
Nope. I don't.
So knowing it's Tama now, you're.
But no, I'd order. So,
I love the Tsundere Fuki. Like, every time she shows up at the cafe, she's obviously in love with Mika, but she doesn't want to admit it. She just wants to order something. No, Sakura always wants to order something, and Fuki just wants to be Tsundere. Yeah, that's Licorice Coil. Check out my many millions. If you're a hyper fan of Licorice Coil, I have tons of content on YouTube that you can check out. So just a plug. Moving on, we have Engage Kiss. This one streamed on Crunchyroll, ran for 13 episodes, done by Studio A1 Pictures. Another originals are there. That was their second original for Saturdays. It was pretty cool. Genres are action, comedy, romance, supernatural. Writer is Fumiaki Maruto, who did Saikano How to Raise a Born Girlfriend, White Album, and Classroom Crisis. Character designs by Tsunako, who did Day Live, Ange Verge, and Hyperdimension Neptunia. And I guess I have to correct, it is original. But it is a multimedia project, so mobile game. Engage Kill is where they went to with this series, which is fantastic. Yay. You didn't get to watch the show, or you did not watch the show.
I gave up after a relationship and a forgetting.
Which is the whole show. Gotcha. So somewhere in between episode 1 and 13.
It was, I think, episode 4 or something like that.
Yeah. Well, anyways, this one opens up in a floating island that was created on top of this resource that they end up finding. Mankind was looking around, mining around. They end up finding this new resource, which was a very fruitful resource that they wanted to use. But the oddity that happens is after building this town on this island, this incident happens. And what we come to find out is that over time, there is these demon packs being happening. Like, there is demons amongst the humans, and the government itself is trying to cover it up. They don't want the existence of demons to be known. Well, every now and then, whenever a human makes a pact with a demon, this organization will find out about it, and then they will do, like, a bidding war to these different mercenary groups that will bid towards this job to taking out the demon. And unfortunately for a lot of these companies, There is the existence of Shu, who is this guy that underbids everybody because his whole goal is to take down as many demons as possible and find out what happened to his family a long time ago. So he ends up underbidding everybody, going out there and taking out the demon. He doesn't do it himself. He actually has at his side Kisara, who is a demon. Who at some point, this organization tried to do a bid war and all the companies tried to take her out, but she's like an S-ranked demon, so she quickly wiped the floor with them. So they kind of accepted Shu and Kisara to join the organization and take out other demons because they didn't want to fight. They just want to help them take out the demons. So fight fire with fire, so to speak. So we basically follow Shu as he takes on different jobs or underbids a lot of jobs, all while trying to uncover what happened to his family in the past. We also have Ayano, who was his past coworker and somebody he's known for a long time, somebody that they actually went out, you know, dated at some point. He used to work for the company that her mother owns, and he left that company, got Kisara, and now works on his own. So, yeah.
They introduced Sharon in the last episode I watched.
Yeah, that's like, what, 6 or something like that. Or maybe it's like 5. Yeah, Sharon's like some nun that works for this big church that all they care about is killing all demons, which everybody does. So that's nothing special. They won't accept the idea of fighting fire with fire, though. So that's the big problem there. She doesn't like Kisara. Their organization doesn't like her existence. So whereas the humans, they'll use Kisara to fight the demons because she's not doing anything bad so far. And yeah, technically within about 4 or so episodes, you get a sense early on, but over time you'll get a sense that Shu is kind of a jerk. He feels like he's a jerk. Like this Ayano girl.
You get that
girl,
impression within 5 minutes. Come on.
Yeah, he's like, he's mooching off this Ayano girl, his past girlfriend. I mean, he's even like saying, oh crap, sorry, you can't call me because my phone bill. And she's like, oh, give me the phone bill, I'll pay it. She's literally like his ATM. But we get a sense really quickly and then kind of confirm within the first 4 or so episodes is that every person that makes a pact with a demon, they have to do some sort of sacrifice. In most cases, it's their life. Like a human has to sacrifice their entire existence to manifest a demon to cause problems. Well, Shu's pact with Kisara is to give up his memories. So every time she kisses, and that's part of the pact too, is that she has to kiss him. Every time she kisses him, she takes a memory from him, and that kind of turns into power that Kisara can use to destroy other demons. And so what this kind of creates this issue of Shu is sacrificing all of his memories, all of his experiences, and yes, technically even his relationship with Ayano to gain power, to destroy the demons, to get a resolve and answers for what happened to his family, because that's his driving force. He wants to figure out what happened to his sister, his mom, his father, all that kind of stuff. So it's kind of a sacrifice to resolve his own issues. So, yeah. My thoughts on this series. It looks great. I think the character designs are fantastic. Kisara is super cute. She's the Yandere character. Ayano is... my heart breaks for Ayano. Ayano, I feel so bad for Ayano. Early on, it was so funny because in the first episode, you get the sense of like Ayano is responsibilities and she wants him to get a proper job. She wants him to live successful. She wants him to be happy in his life. He's currently living in an apartment. They're shutting down his power and everything because he can't pay any of his bills. She wants him to come back to the organization, get a proper job, and live a normal life. Whereas Kisara is like the, you know, adolescent. She's the cute and the, yes, technically Yandere side of everything. So it's like that pull between responsibilities and what you want kind of thing. It almost gave me a vibe of that, Catherine, the video game where he had like here's your fiance and here is the fling. It kind of gave me a sense of that. But, and yeah, and then technically Sharon is the, you would think, pure nun. Yeah. So anyways, getting back to my point, I love all the characters. They're fantastic. And like I said, my heart broke for Ayano. Shu, at first, I hated him, but in the grand scheme of things, he makes sense in the whole idea of giving up all of his memories and existence. And that becomes kind of an overall plot line. And at some point, some character even mentions the idea that, you know, it's not the fact that you're giving up each individual memory. It's the fact that the culmination of all of your memories is what makes you you. And I think they did a pretty good job of kind of portraying that. But I think my biggest problem with the series, and the action scenes are great, A1 Pictures did a great job with the action scenes. I think there was a couple in the after the first episode that were a little bit kind of shrug, but overall, I think especially towards the later part, they ramped up the action scenes and the animation. I almost felt like they took all the people from Licorice Quill and brought them over to work on finishing up Engage Kiss, probably to get ready to ramp up to the mobile game. So you know how that works. Gotta ramp up for that those big sales in that gacha game. But no, I think overall, action, character designs, characters themselves, it was fine. My biggest beef with the series is how it was portrayed, I think, was a huge, huge disappointment. I had this big issue early on. Like, this was one of the shows, along with Licorice Quill, that I was planning on doing weekly impressions on, because I thought, again, it had a cool concept there. The problem that I was having was that the story for the first half of the entire series was telling and not showing. Like, the gravest sin that I could ever give any series is telling and not showing. I think that's just horrible writing. You constantly have these cases where these characters are standing on the sideline saying what happened to Shu, saying how he met Kisara, telling us about how they first came back to the city, telling us about what happened in the past. And it's like, show what happened. Some incident happened with Shu and his family when he was young. Show it. Don't tell me. I don't want a big, long dialogue about what's happening. People saying what Shu should feel about the idea of demons having to be, you know, stuck in the underground and the existence of demons not being known. Stop telling me. Show me an example of that. It was frustrating. The earlier segments of this series absolutely frustrated with me with how much show or tell no show it was doing. And it compounds when the second half of the show literally shows you what they were telling and not showing. And so I have to hear the story from people's words. And then the second half, we finally get to see it. So I get to replay everything, but actually get what I originally wanted. It almost felt like they were trying to turn 6 episodes into 13 episodes by telling the story twice, the first time with dialogue and the second time with actually animation. It was extremely frustrating, and I think it was very poorly presented. But again, the overall core concept of memories and sacrifice, all for the sake of what you're going for, was still good. The ending, the last couple episodes was just like, what are we even doing? What are we even doing? It almost felt like they were trying to kind of sidetrack the story just to throw in another character at the very end. But it's kind of sad, because what ends up concluding with the series is really resolving only one thing. Like, the overall story doesn't really even get touched. The concept of the demons rising up from the ashes, basically, of the underground, all that kind of stuff, the power, the cover-ups, all that stuff never really gets touched. And again, it didn't make sense at the time that I finished the series. Made perfect sense the moment they released the trailer for Engage Kill right after the series end, which tells us, oh, by the way, we didn't resolve anything of the overall story plot because we want to use it in the mobile game. So here's the mobile game where you get to play as a mercenary group that takes down the demons and all this other story about around the companies and stuff. Really does throw a huge sour taste on the entire story when you realize it's all just to open up. It's all basically a prologue to the mobile game, which was funny because in the last episode, I paused at some point and I said, wait, what's this random group of very unique looking characters walking down the street? Does this mean a sequel? No, they're the group that you play as in the game. So that's why they randomly show up. Overall, it's a good fun ride. I wish it would have ramped up a little bit more on the harem aspects a little bit more. I think it's halfway through the show, it feels like the harem stuff kind of toned down quite a bit. I mean, they're still there. And again, I think the core story of Shu and his memories and stuff was still a cool concept, even though it was retread twice, because the first time they had to tell us and the second time they had to show us. So if none of that bothers you, definitely check it out. It was a decent show. I enjoyed it in the end. So it's Engage Kiss. Check it out. Black Summoner or Kuro no Shokanshi. This one streamed on Crunchyroll, done by Studio Satellite. The source is a light novel. The genres are action, adventure, and fantasy. This one opens up with a guy that is later known as Kelvin, or he realizes his name is Kelvin. He's a guy that's been reincarnated into a fantasy world. And he's quickly met by the goddess of reincarnation, who tells him, oh, hey, what's up? Yeah, you've been reincarnated. Your past life self said that you wanted to basically sell all of your memories so that you can have more stat points so that you can be distributed into your new skills. And he said that he's going to choose the perfect skills for you that's going to make your next life super cool. You're a tamer, by the way. And, oh, yeah, by the way, your past self also fell in love with me immediately, so I decided to join you. And I can't show you quite yet because you can't summon me yet because you're not that powerful. But when you do see me, I'm sure you'll fall in love with me again. And so he goes on his adventures as a tamer in this world and taming a bunch of stuff and being overpowered. Because here's where I struggle with which ones I'm remembering. He's an S-class summoner, which there's not really, I think there's like, what, one other one or something like that? I forget. There's like very rare amounts of summoners.
One
like
per region.
Like he doesn't want to reveal that he is a summoner.
It's supposed to be one per region.
Yeah, they're like super powerful. So he doesn't want anybody to know that he's a summoner, even though that quickly gets kind of revealed and then never talked about again. but his whole thing is that he like advances stats by like, what was it, like 100 or something like that. So like if he tames a slime, the slime is basically like has 100 in all stats, which normally only has like one of each stat. So anything he tames can technically be boosted up, and he's super overpowered, obviously, because he's an isekai character. Over time, he ends up meeting a girl that is being sold, and he ends up buying her. She has his curse. He's super overpowered, so he's able to get rid of the curse. Ends up beating this other demon, gets this demon girl. I think I'll probably just leave it at that. He has a slime he's power leveled up to massive amounts. And oh yeah, there's this thing about the fact that he's like a battle junkie and his past self was a battle junkie. So he's a battle junkie. I didn't really get that too much very well portrayed, but he's a battle junkie. So he likes battles. And so he goes out of his way to do stupid things in order to have battles. So your thoughts? And goofy CGI. CGI.
I generally enjoy myself watching the show. There's a lot of fun things in here that I did think that I kind of... Here's my thing. Some of the things that I think that set this show kind of aside and makes it unique to itself took too long to get to. And unfortunately, because of how long it took to get to these points, it ultimately makes you feel a little bit unsatisfied in the end. And it's one of those frustrating things. Me and Andrew were talking ahead of time about this and kind of one of the things that does pop up in the show is there's like 1.5 million isekais in this show, in this story, in this world. And that's one of the funny things about this is with all of these isekai, it actually adds an interesting tidbit to what Kelvin is doing in this world. By the way, I hate Kelvin's design. He looks stupid.
Like the Gundam antenna?
What the heck is that thing? but it does add an interesting tidbit to what it is that he's bringing to this world. And ultimately, towards the end, stat screen says that he's a hero trainer. And that's an interesting aspect of what it is that he's bringing to this world is him in himself is not the hero of the story. He's actually the one that is helping the heroes become really good. But at the same time, understand, yes, that's an interesting tidbit. And I wish that they had delved into this more, but unfortunately that's unsatisfying by the end of the story. You're not going to get enough out of that one little tidbit in the 2 or 3 episodes that they do start doing that kind of stuff. So it's one of those things. There's an interesting aspect to this, but it's so far into the story that you're not going to get a real good, satisfying, wow, this is something that you should come to the show for. So yeah, I'm 50-50 on this. I do like the show. I had a lot of fun watching the show, but when it comes down to it, ultimately it's a kind of unsatisfying story.
It's better than My Isekai Life.
Yes. I'm biased for My Harem Labyrinth, but when it comes down to it, between Black Summoner and My Isekai Life, I like this one a lot more.
Yeah, this is that's about all the positive I can say is it's at least it's better than My Isekai Life. I agree. The only real kind of interesting hook to this series is the fact that because the Battle Junkie thing, I think, is just, it didn't do anything for me. Like, it wasn't, it felt like that was kind of the draw, the stinger for the synopsis for the series is that, oh, by the way, he's a battle junkie and he loves battling. It's like, yeah, I see it here and there, but it's like, it's never satisfying. It's not like, like if it was portrayed in a more of a way of something like Demon King Academy, where that dude, when he goes out, it's like, oh yes, here we go, dude. He's gonna go all out. Like, you know, he's into it. It didn't really work here at all, and it just all it really meant was that he would, I think he would grin slightly, and then everybody goes, oh, there he goes again. That's Kelvin for you. He's a battle junkie, and everybody just kind of goes, ha, 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 battle junkie. And you almost can hear the sitcom crowd in the background laughing. And yeah, it just doesn't work. So really, in the end, the only thing they kind of add here that's unique is the fact that yes, there's a lot of isekais here, and he kind of crossed paths with them here and there, and their significance to his story is literally zero. One time he trains a group, one time he technically brings it into play, and he fights one. That's about it. And the rest is kind of unsatisfying. The overall story doesn't feel like it goes anywhere. I was kind of surprised they didn't announce a second season immediately, because it kind of feels like a straight up source material bait. But I don't know. Overall did not do really anything for me in the end, and I didn't really get anything out of it. So I don't really, it's kind of still, it's better than My Isekai Life, but it not by much. So in the end, I didn't really, and I mean, it had a couple points that I kind of smiled. There was the whole power leveling point that I had a huge chuckle out of, because I remember doing that in World of Warcraft, where you would have your friends kind of hang out at the entrance of the instance, and you go in, you mow everything down, and all the experience goes to them. I kind of had a little chuckle at that idea, because he comes in there with his maids. These maids that are completely not combat, and they're like, why are we here? And he's like, ah, oh, don't worry about it, just chill here for a minute. And they just completely decimate the entire forest, and you see this level up come up. Surprised they didn't level up more than that. They were decimating the entire forest. But yeah, that's it's Black Summoner. If you're looking for another isekai overpowered main character, but this time he's a battle junkie and he has a Gundam antenna on his ear. Check that out if that sounds interesting to you. Hopefully I get another season, because I think it could possibly get into something interesting, but I'm not gonna say it will. Awashi! Let's move on to a show I can be positive about. This one streamed on Crunchyroll, ran for 24 episodes, done by Production IG. Sources of manga, genres are sports and drama. Series composition by Masahiro Yokotani, who did ReZero, Rascal Does Not Dream of Bone Girl Senpai, and Sakura Quest. Really fantastic series composition writer. Yeah, this one opens up following a guy named Ao Ashito, and he is a part of a school club for soccer. Seems like they're like way out in the sticks. All of his teammates are kind of useless. He pretty much established the moment he joined their team, like, I am a fantastic forward. Just get me the soccer ball. Don't worry about anything else. Just give me that soccer ball and I'll get it to the goal, which works out well for them. I mean, they're playing their little games and he always gets the ball and he gets up to that goal and he gets it in there. Well, unfortunately, during this one kind of very critical game, he ends up getting confronted by somebody that he knows from the past that makes fun of him and his mom, and how his mom is scraping for money to get shoes for him. And he kind of gets a little bit violent. So they pretty much lose the game for that situation. Well, at the same time, he's being scouted by a guy named Fukuda. And Fukuda is actually a part of the Tokyo City Asperion youth team. And he has scouted Ao Ashito to basically recruit him, or at least bring him in for trials for their team. And Ashito's like, oh, that sounds great. I really want to do that. But unfortunately, again, his family's not well off. His mom's barely scraping by. She's basically living, you know, scrounging everything she can just to get him what he needs for his soccer. So, but it seems like his brother really wants to support him. So his brother gives him enough money so that he can at least get to the tryouts. He gets to the tryouts, really struggles quite a bit there, but in the end impresses them to the point that he gets accepted. Well, that's one issue down. He still has the issue with living in Tokyo to go there. So this kind of turns this whole thing where obviously his mother really wants him to do this. She feels like whatever he does, you know, really commit himself to, he will succeed. And so she basically sits down with this girl named Hana that he met while he was at the tryouts. Hana is the sister of Fukuda. Hana pretty much gives the mother like every information about every finance that he's going to need in order to make this happen. And his mother basically figures out if she can possibly actually do it. And turns out she's able to, and he goes off to join the Tokyo City Hesperion youth team. So that's where things get really rough, because that from that point on, it's basically about Ashito realizing he doesn't know anything about sports. Well, he doesn't know anything about, you know, playing in a team. He doesn't understand soccer as a team. He's always worked as a forward, get it to the goal, you win. Whereas when he's surrounded by actual pros, they all know what they're doing and they're all working as a team, and you can't beat a team as yourself. You have to beat a team with a team. And so it becomes a huge grind for Ashito to understand and trust his fellow teammates and learn basic things like triangle formations for forwards and everything about defense and all this other stuff that surrounds soccer itself. And he has a lot of the rules that surround it. So that becomes a key point going forward. They get into some side characters. A lot of his teammates have their own kind of issues they're facing. It doesn't get into a lot of the characters' full backstories, but a lot of them are really kind of tied in with each other. There's a huge emphasis on essentially how their group, their team, is kind of comprised of two different factions, in a sense, that they've kind of deemed themselves as having. You have one faction is essentially those that, you know, actually climbed from the bottom up. They were in the earlier years of this particular school, and they advanced into this particular team. Whereas you have people like Ashito and many others who were scouted from other schools and brought in for different unique talents that they have. And so seeing how all those each talents come together, and yes, deal with the fact that some of them believe they're better than the others because they were there the whole time, or if they were just scouted in, is a main kind of critical point there. So yeah, my thoughts on this series, I absolutely loved it. And this is coming from somebody that I mostly miss when it comes to sports anime. Typically with sports anime, if it doesn't grab me within the first couple episodes, it doesn't get me. And I think that's mostly to do with the fact that I need a larger balance in the scales of characters versus sport itself. If it spends so much time getting into the sports, it loses me very quickly. I've enjoyed a lot in the past of things like, you know, Run with the Wind, Remain, Big Wind Up. There's a lot of sports shows out there that I've really enjoyed, and it's always about how much character is in the show. And I think what helped this show specifically is early on, it felt so much about family. Now, granted, I feel like that kind of at some point gets lost. They kind of hit back on it at some point, but the earlier segments really did gut punch me with family. This family, this mother that really does love her children, wants the best of them, but does have limits. Like, the finances are still a limit there, and the willingness of the mother to really push those boundaries of the budget just to give, you know, Ashito this chance to get out there, get that new pair of shoes that he's going to need in order to start his new, essentially, a career. Ashito is a career choice. It's an investment from his mother that he is going to be successful. And so that does weigh on Ashito. He goes over there and he hits this brick wall. Like, nobody wants to pass him the ball. He can't figure out why. And they basically say, you know why I'm mad at you? Figure it out. And Ashito doesn't know. He doesn't understand. And he still realized at some point, even though I feel like I'm being kicked out by the team, I can't quit. He even envisions it. Going back home and going, sorry, mom. Sorry, bro. I messed up. It failed. Let's get back to our previous life. He doesn't want to. He realizes that investment's there and he can't fail. This is something that he has to succeed at. So it is technically at his deepest core, his driving force. But over time, it becomes kind of the love of the sport itself. A couple of things here. Yes, side characters. Really enjoyed a lot of them. Specifically, Togashi, he is literally he's the rough guy. You see the pompadour. Chris sees the pompadour. He's going to be the rough guy. The guy that just clashes heads with everybody. But getting into essentially how Ashito confronts him, getting a little bit into how he originally got there, was all really solid. Hana. I love Hana. Hana's gone down as easily one of my favorite characters of this entire year. Granted, she kind of disappeared in the second half for a little bit. But overall, Hana made the show. She's just absolutely a heart of gold. I love her to death. And yes, Henri did technically for quite a while still the show as well. Hana is basically, she really looked up to Fukuto, her quote-unquote brother, somebody that was kind of brought into her family, but she really did love Fukuto. And at some point, Hana sees Fukuda in Ashito. That's why she becomes Ashito's first fan. And so she's the first one on the sideline that is cheering for him. And you have all these other people there that are cheering for different people. Because Asparian Group is huge. People love coming to even the training just to cheer for their player. But she is Ashito's first fan. And so she's always there kind of supporting on the side. She's making like food regimens for him to help him get better. Because she sees Fukuda in Ashito. And what you'll find out later on is that she doesn't know about soccer. Like, despite the fact that she loves Fukuda and looked up to him and now looks up to Ashito, she doesn't know much about soccer. Like, she's constantly asking questions of people on the sidelines. She does not know what they're doing. Like, if something crazy happens, everybody's going, oh, I can't believe they just pulled that move off. She's like, what'd they do? They're like, oh, you don't know what they did. They did this, this, and this, this. And she realized really quickly that she doesn't know much about it. Whereas Henri is a girl that is actually, she's, her father is like this big contributor to the Asparion. So she's kind of seen as like the lady coming in and everybody kind of, you know, respects her and stuff. But she actually wants to be a manager. So she knows everything about soccer. And when I see her start juggling a soccer ball, man, she stole my heart right there. Girl was juggling that soccer ball like nothing. And like I said, she kind of stole the show because she starts to actually coach Ashito. And she knows what she's talking about. And so Hana kind of gets pushed off the side. But eventually, again, they kind of sweep it back around. I'm like, oh my gosh. I love all these characters. Like, they're all fantastic. And the great thing is, the last ones I really want to get into is Fukuda and Date. I cannot express how well this writer, and technically in the adaptation, pulled off making me think one character is nasty and another character is essentially the helper. Like, this person knows what's best for Ashito. He's going to help Ashito. He looks out for Ashito. And this other person seems like a jerk. And then at some point, it flips it. And I go, the whole time, this person was actually supporting Ashito, and this person's actually a explicitive. I loved how they pulled that off. Now, in the end, they're coaches. They're going to know what's best for their player. They see the potential, they know their boundaries, and that's exactly what they portray in the show. At some point, there is a turning point for Ashito, and they completely flip the script on him and really challenge what Ashito's goal is. Is it to be play the game how he wants to play it, or is it to be a part of the team and to do what was going to actually get him to go pro? And that was a huge point in which they basically say, Ashito, do you care about being a professional, or do you care about playing how you want to play it? And I think that willingness for it makes all sense in the end, honestly, but to really kind of change how he even views soccer completely. I'm being vague to not spoil things, but to change how he views soccer completely was pretty fascinating. And I thought it was a really cool, again, like, quote unquote, turning point for the entire series. So the sad thing is this is barely scratching the manga. I think they only adapted, I think, maybe a quarter, maybe a third at the most of the entire manga. I was really hoping for a second season, but it's like some sports animes keep going and they never die. Some sports animes, they get one season, that's it. I do really, really hope we get another season because I got a really big payoff at the end of the season, and it just made me want more so bad. It was kind of dropping off in it, for me towards the later part, honestly, because they got really deep into the soccer game that they were playing, and it started losing me. There was some cool points in it. It started losing me, but it was huge payoff at the end, a huge, huge payoff. So I want more. I desperately need it. And kind of sad this one doesn't get as much chat as most other shows, but I guess it's because it's a soccer anime. Who wants to watch a soccer anime unless you're a big super soccer anime or super sports fan anime person? So my review of this show video did crap. I'm like, nobody wants to watch my review. It's like, I love this show. Somebody watch this video.
Like 90% of our audience is going, what the heck are you talking about, soccer? It's football.
Yeah, football. Sorry. Awashi. Definitely a high suggestion from me, especially if you like sports anime with specifically characters. So, Parallel World Pharmacy or Isekai Yakyoku. This one streamed on Crunchyroll for 12 episodes, done by Studio Dio Media. The source is a light novel. The genres are fantasy. The director on this one was Keizo Kusakawa, who did Happy Sugar Life, Kankoli, and Ryukbu. And the series composition by Wataru Watari, who, of course, is the creator of romantic comedy Snafu, and Girlish Number, as well as series composition for Saint's Magic Powers Omnipotent. So there you go. This one follows a guy who, in our current time Japan, is kind of overworking himself. You kind of get a sense early in his life, he lost his sister to some sort of tumor or something like that. There was no cure for it, so she ended up passing away. So he pretty much dedicated his life following that tragedy to find cures for other people, to make sure that nobody would deal with the same situation he did, where there's no cure and you face tragedy. Again, he overworks himself to the point where he just croaks. He croaks and he wakes up in the body of a boy named Fama de Medicis. Yes, he goes into the body of a boy named Fama de Medicis. Anyways, he kind of quickly finds out that this Fama de Medicis, he was out in the field or something like that and got struck by lightning, and that's why he was unconscious, and that's when he woke up. And it kind of insinuates that he entered this body through this lightning. But following this, also, this Fama de Medicis, this body that he's in, also has a mark on his shoulder, which indicates the god of, was it medicine or something like that? Or I think it's the god of medicine or something like that. Anyways, he quickly finds out that he's a part of this big noble family that is known for their skill in medicine. And so in order to not get kicked out of the noble family, he has to both be really good at medicine and good at divine arts. Good, fine with that first part, because he really knows his medicine. And technically, this world is quite a step back in medicine than our current times. So a lot of the books and stuff that this child that he's now incarnated into was reading are, again, medicines that are outdated. But the problem is he doesn't know how to use divine arts. He quickly figures it out, but he really doesn't know how to control it, because his mana capabilities, you know, through the roof, because overpowered main character. Does a study session with Ellen, who is his tutor. She freaks out because he's super overpowered and his mana capabilities out the roof. So she screams, running away, bloody murder, because he has no shadow and he has this eye thing that only God should have. And believes that he's some sort of demon, possibly. But yeah, it kind of, from this point on, turns this whole aspect of Pharma kind of, again, transfers his devotion in his previous life to his new life. He's realizing at this point that things like commoners don't get proper medical care because they don't have much money. So he tries to do some things for a couple people around the mansion to help them out, a lot of the servants. And at some point ends up going with his father to see the queen, who the queen is dealing with a illness that pretty much everybody's wrote off as death. And he eventually figures out what's ailing her and creates a regimen to help her, you know, get over that illness. And that eventually opens up his big pharmacy, Parallel World Pharmacy, which they went way too far building that building because nobody wants to go to there. It's like, hey, I want to create this place where all the commoners can go. Let's build this huge, gigantic, rich-looking mansion. Hey, come on, commoners. You definitely can feel comfortable in here.
It's practically a hospital.
It's basically, yeah, it's like a modern-day hospital in the middle of this, like, run-down commoner section. But yeah, your thoughts.
This one is going to be probably one of the most difficult ones to kind of portray my feelings on. In a lot of ways, I really do. All said and done, love the show. Okay, one of the biggest frustrations that I have with this show is that it the storyline as a whole. When all is said and done, me and Andrew were back talking back and forth on this one, and one of the biggest frustrations I have with this is all said and done, I will probably never explore this story in the future. There's a lot of stories I don't follow in the future, but when it comes down to it, I don't feel a drive to go into the light novels is my point. Mostly because of the fact that the biggest thing that you could possibly ever deal with as far as a antagonist per se, if you want to call it that, he deals with diseases. The biggest possible disease that you could ever come up with was thrown into the second thing that he had to deal with. I mean, it's like taking the big bad out within the first three episodes. What's there to be scary of later? And Andrew had brought up the alternative, something else that they could go into.
Yeah, lots of them get into, including stuff that wasn't in his original world.
And that's the thing.
That's technically going to be his biggest challenge if he faces something that he's not familiar with.
Right. And that's the thing is, Yeah, I guess that could be something that would be interesting in the future. But when it comes down to it, it's the namesake of this story is Pharmacy in Another World. So,
actually, Parallel World Pharmacy.
It's parallel. I know. My point being is that he's bringing knowledge from his other life into it, and he's fighting the biggest, baddest in the world already. So, yeah, I guess Divine Arts would be something, but that's not what I came here for. Technically, I came here for the stuff involved with the pharmacy in Another World. And so, yeah, I'm quibbling in a lot of ways, but this is my why I find myself in this frustration point in this show. Is the storyline, I loved the idea of him coming in, bringing this knowledge. Divine Arts, whatever. It scares Ellen, but Ellen comes back. When we go into letter parts, the frustration of him basically overturning the entire system by a young buck coming in and taking and healing the queen over these very old, respected pharmacists and the way that they were doing things before, and this young buck just comes in and just takes all the pomp and circumstance right out from under them, and his dad deals with that in his way, and I love how a lot of that was portrayed. Some of it is cheesy as all get out, but it still, in a lot of cases, it would hit. When he ended up with a pharmacist and that story later on, I could see it. It was all there. The writing was all over the place, but yet it still worked. I loved it. And I went to Andrew immediately and I said, this episode was cheesy as all get out, but it was great. I thought it was perfect. And some of the latter parts, there's other things that they do and they get into, and it's, you can see it. It's all right there, and you know it's coming, and it still kind of just twists it in its own way and makes it work. And so there's a lot of stuff that I'm really excited about. But ultimately, do I want to keep going after this? Not really. And that's my frustration.
Jeez, Chris, super negative. I feel like I was going to start mine with like the negatives and go into the positives, but I feel like I have to start with the positives. No, to echo what you're saying there, I think my biggest criticisms of this series is around how absolutely obvious everything is. Like, from the very beginning, when you see this guy who is a competitor, or at least somebody of the guild that Pharma's not a part of, which is the pharmacy guild, when he's walking around trying to find somebody to treat his daughter who has a fever, obviously he's going to go to Pharma, obviously he's going to get kicked out of the guild, and obviously Pharma's going to recruit him into his guild. All that plays out. Cedric gets fired by his dad. Obvious that his dad wants him to hire him. He will hire him. He'll bring him in. Everything feels so obvious. From the first 2 minutes, you know what the entire episode's going to, how it's going to play out. It's super obvious, and everything just goes into play. If somebody is casually talking about how something is happening in the city, obviously Pharma is going to get involved with it at some point. But it still, I think, works mainly because how it's portrayed. Like, you know what's going to happen, but it presents it so well. And I think Pharma as a whole is a very genuine person. He's somebody you root for. You think he's, even though the fact that he is this old man actually technically inside of this child's body, he's a good boy. Like, you want to support this kid, you know, helping people. That's because he's genuine. He wants to help everybody. He wants medical care to everybody. He wants to provide that to everybody. And he's not saying that he wants it. He's doing it. And I think that's something that you can stand by and respect. I think, like I said before, how it's presented is where it kind of nails it. It, from the very beginning, it pulled it off. Like, from the beginning, the first episode was, like, super shrug. Like, it felt so like a copy of Mushoku Tensei, but not. I mean, he even shoots water bolts out the window, just like Mushoku. Like, everything feels like Mushoku. And even how he's, like, you know, technically creating the magic and doing all the particles and what makes up the object itself is how he creates the magic. It's very Mushoku. But it kind of grabbed me at the very end because Ellen seems doesn't go, "Oh, Sugoi, you're super overpowered, Sugoi." She literally goes, "Holy heck, I'm out of here," and runs out the freaking bushes and out to probably a cliffside. We don't even know where she runs to. It was a nice little funny ending to the whole thing. But I think it was like the moment that he really sits down with the queen and everybody's writing off that she's dead. And she knows that they're doing that because she knows medicine. But it was cool that he doesn't just come in there and goes, "Here's the cure." And he doesn't just cast cure spell and she gets healed. He goes off. He creates the regimen, gets in a huge fight with his father because his father's like, "Who the hell are you? My son wouldn't do this." Figures out this cure, this regimen, and comes back to the queen. Doesn't say, "Take this. You're good." He actually sits down and goes, "Here, let me show you this." And he takes out like this little makeshift magnifying glass that he put together and shows her, "This is what you're dealing with." Shows to everybody, "This is what she's dealing with. This is what's going to cure you. And not only are you going to take this on a regular basis, I'm going to come here every time and I'm going to take it along with you. So you know I'm taking the same thing. So you know it's good." And that's what he kind of does with everything. And it feels overwordy, but it gives you a sense this writer knows what he's talking about. This writer technically knows medicine. Like, I think he was like a past pharmacist or something like that. He knows medicine. He knows what was required. He knows the chemical compounds. And he breaks all that stuff down with every patient. And he sounds like a doctor. Like, at some point, when he's trying to explain to this commoner pharmacist guy, like, what his daughter's dealing with, and he's explaining all this terminology that he's not even aware of because it's way advanced from what he's at. It's like you get that sense of every now and then he kind of says, "Tell him what?" Like, layman's term kind of moments. He explains it all. And like I said, he's very, you know, you kind of back him because, again, he seems very genuine about what he's doing. I mean, though, again, even though every story kind of feels very conveniently laid out, the later stuff that it gets into, I thought was really cool. I thought it was how they were laying down essentially a big festival and trying to prevent something. And so all the little pieces that they put into play in order to prevent a big disaster from happening was really cool. How they laid that stuff out, how they did all the essentially locking down an entire city and really trying to piece out different triaging, basically. All that stuff was really cool. In the end, though, the last part sucked. The last part sucked. Like, they had to make a big bad character, and I really was frustrated by that. And plus, on top of that, there was so much buildup, and I really liked this final arc. I really thought it was a really cool thing for him to have to face. It felt really cool having all this stuff into play to prevent issues, to help people. Yes, even having Lost in play with it. And then it felt like at the very end, it just undid everything. Like, it felt like this last few seconds of the entire show just undid everything. It was like this big, big hammer hits the ground and poof, magic. And it's like, oh, please don't undo everything you've worked and built up. But if I can forget that one last part, it's a really good show. It's not in the levels of something like Mushoku Tensei, but I give it credit for feeling like that same writing that I love in that series. Not that it has great characters and great overarching stories and a lot of mystery and stuff that I really want to dig into and I gotta have the next volume. It just felt very, very, a very light version of it that just hits the certain parts just perfectly, has a great character, presents each of these little issues that he runs into really well. And in the end, I enjoyed it. I thought it was a really solid. It's kind of like one of those, you know, if you go through season to season, you have pretty much the throwaways like My Isekai Life and Black Summoner. And then every now and then you'll have that big ticket one like Mushoku Tensei or Tsukimichi Moonlit Fantasy. This is kind of one of those ones in the middle there. Like, if you have some time and you want another Isekai, yes, hit it. Don't bother with these other two over here. Hit this one. So, yeah, it's a Parallel World Pharmacy. Check that out if you... That was cute. I like... I mentioned earlier this idea that he built this huge mansion and they're like, "Why isn't anybody coming to the pharmacy? Everything's super cheap and everything."
She goes out and does a survey.
She literally shows up and she's like... No, there was the problem was they're like, "We don't know why they don't come in here. Why won't they come in here? We got to figure out why they're not coming in here." And she comes and goes, "I asked them why they're not coming in here." Girl did what, like... Because Pharma is an adult. He's in a child's body. You have literally three adults in this room. Cedric is pretty darn old. Fama's pretty close to Cedric. And then you have Ellen, who's probably in her, 20s or something like that. Oldest sticks in anime years. Lutz comes in. I think she was, 10 years old. She comes and goes, "I asked them why they're not coming in, and they told me." It's like, oh my gosh. Hold on. Save these stupid people. This is the primary definition of too smart, too dumb. You have a pharmacist guy that knows all this stuff, and he's like, oh, I can't figure out why people won't come in the door. Did you ask him? Oh, no, I haven't asked him. Anyways, there you go. Parallel with pharmacy. Moving on. Not My Strike Witches is our next one. League of Nations Air Force Aviation Magic Band Luminous Witches. Oreme, Kugun, Koko, Maho, Ongak, Kutai, Luminous Witches. This was streamed on High Dive, ran for 12 episodes, done by Studio Shaft. I keep having to remind myself that Shaft worked on this. The source is original. I have ecchi music. It's genres are music. There's no ecchi in the show. Not My Strike Witches. Director, it was Shoji Seki, who did Assault Lilies. That makes a lot of sense now. Playtus and Madoka Box.
Is this... do you think maybe Shaft put all their effort into this one over the Ruby?
They didn't put effort in either one of them, Chris. Or they just didn't want to put effort into anything, and they just kind of split whatever little effort they have into two. Anyways, yes, this is... basically a idol show that co-ops the Strike Witches universe and makes it into the core concept of the story. Let me be serious. At the core of Luminous Witches, the concept is that you have this girl named Gracie who is trying to create a place for all the rejects of the Strike Witches, because in this world, certain girls at some point will become a Strike Witch or a witch, and they can then join the Strike Witches so that they can go out and fight this alien force that's attacking everybody. But the problem is that some of them suck. Like, you might be a witch, but then you can't shoot for shot. You're not good. You don't have good eyesight. You might be a failure at using your magic. You might have too low of a magic capability. And then there's a problem with at some point you will be retired. Like, you can run out. There's a point in which they, like, close to their 20s, hitting their 20s, they will lose their witch's powers. So it's kind of trying to create a place for the rejects. And so Gracie proposes to the big generals and stuff, I want to create a group of singers and stuff that will come together that are the rejects that will help the war efforts without combat. So if you can't shoot very well, you can come to this group and sing and at least both help those that have been had their homes destroyed by the alien forces, or you can bolster the army itself by singing for them. So that's their whole goal, is to bring all these girls together, train them to sing, and then go out and do performances to help morale for people. So, yeah, so basically they send out a little message out, and all these girls join up. They ask them why they want to join. None of them want to join to sing, but they join. Because I got kicked out of this. Like, they're interviewing all these girls, and their reasons are just not to sing. Like, one came there because she wanted to tell them about this girl named Guinea, who's a really good singer. One wanted to join because she just really looks up to this one singer. One came there. It's just that none of them wanted to join to sing. And so it's like they're surprised by this. It's like, well, you put out a missive that basically says, we need the rejects, the people that can't fight. It's not like they're going to join because they can sing or anything. They're going to join because they can't fight. So, yeah. So they get together. You get, like, an episode to each one of these girls, pretty much. Each one of them having some sort of backstory or something that you can get into a little bit into. Or there's some shortcoming they have that they want to get over. Like, one girl just kind of overcomplicates things because she's just not that good. And so she wants to, yeah. Anyways, your thoughts on Luminous Witches?
I didn't finish it.
Did you even start it?
Yes, I did. I got
to... You said you finished this one.
No.
I put it on the list because you finished it.
Oh, I told you I didn't. No, I got to a pretty much the point in which they... It wasn't a concert, but they were singing in one of the towns. I liked the concept of this show, but it meandered a lot. And that, I think, was probably my biggest frustration with the first few episodes. I don't know that if it would or had any intention of ever getting to the point in which it would have covered what I was interested in this for. And that was the idea of, effectively, like Andrew was mentioning, the rejects becoming morale boosters for both the people and the actual... hopefully the front line, getting out there and actually helping them to feel motivated for some, basically not necessarily motivated to go out there and fight, but necessarily giving them something to fight for, which I think is something that a lot of shows, they tend to touch on it, but they never really truly dig into it. And morale is something that is definitely a thing that is an important key component of actual war situations, is actually handling that morale. And I love the idea of it, but like I said, never finished it. So
yeah, like I said, I think it pulled off the aspect of giving a home for people that don't have a home and giving them a purpose. And yes, technically handing a weapon to somebody who can't hold the weapon and showing them how they can still end up handing it off to the person that can fire it. Here's the ammunition, take it to this person kind of thing. You can still help even though you can't be on the front lines. I think that's an important thing. And I think it pulls it off here and there. Obviously getting a little bit into some of them having lost their homes because they were like in Paris or whatever. Hitting on that stuff was fine. I think overall, those aspects of supporting the war without being in the war and giving hope to those who have lost everything is there. And it does technically have it present, and it does it to an extent. I think it's everything in the between that really bogs down the show. And it's just the fact that the chemistry just, I didn't get much out of the chemistry. The cute girls doing cute things side of what you typically get in an idol show, it just wasn't really there. I didn't really find the chemistry between the characters that great. A lot of the character types and stuff, I guess it's really the writing. The writing just didn't really feel like very inspired. And I think that's where its hugest downfall is. I think really only Milisha's episode, I think, was the only one that I really, really liked. I thought it was a really sweet episode. Maybe Joanne's. I think Joanne was solid as well. Ellie, technically. But overall, in a sense, wasn't really there. I think it was kind of an uphill climb. I want to be truthfully honest. This show had an uphill climb for me. Like, it started in the ditch. The reason why it started in the ditch was because, yes, this isn't my Strike Witches. Coming into this show, I was expecting Strike Witches, and it felt like this was just by brand only. It does have cameos of Strike Witches characters, but Strike Witches for me isn't, you know, cover up everything cute idol girls dancing on the stage. Strike Witches is like 50-50 comedy and action, or ecchi comedy and action. And to not have any ecchi whatsoever in a Strike Witches branded show blows my mind. I mean, technically it's not branded Strike Witches, but it is the Strike Witches name. It's the Strike Witches universe. It's just, for some reason, suddenly in this world, everybody wears pants, which just makes no sense. Like, Strike Witches, the whole theme in that show was the fact, or the a canon aspect of the Strike Witches universe is that they use these propeller feet things, so they run around without pants on because they got to jump into these propellers whenever they need to. And then the people of the world that look up to the Strike Witches, they don't wear pants because they look up to the Strike Witches. And yet everybody wears pants in this world, so it doesn't make any sense. So it was an uphill climb for me. Like, the ecchi was not here. The typical style and dress wear of Strike Witches wasn't here. It's just literally use the brand name, give a place to those that can't fight, idols. And it's obvious, well, most people's arguments as to why it doesn't have the ecchi in the series is because on the side they're doing an actual group. So all these girls, they're going to do an idol group and sell the idol CDs and stuff like that. And it's like, well, didn't stop any other idol show from being ecchi. They're perfectly fine. I mean, even Love Live has ecchi in it. You're telling me that the Strike Witches branded idol group can't have ecchi in the anime? Nobody has expectations of the ecchi in real life. Well, there's some people, but just because, you know, if Inori and Milisha get ecchi doesn't mean I'm going to think they're going to do that on the stage. But I guess I don't know some idol fans. And Love Life fans get crazy too. So maybe that's why Love Life fans are crazy. Point being, this show had an uphill battle for me. And that was because it feels like it's ripping all the ecchi comedy out of a Strike Witches brand and stuff and trying to just cash in on some idol CDs. And I don't think it ever dug out of that hole. So There you go. I guess if you're craving for more Strike Witches and you don't mind the fact that it's none of the spirit of Strike Witches is in it, check it out. But for me, I'm gonna write this off as it's just like the shorts, those Strike Witches shorts that had some studio that literally had no clue how to draw characters. Just like that short, I'm gonna write it off as not existing, and then move on with my life and still keep my collection of Strike Witches on my shelf. So there you go. Strike Witches, or I'm sorry, League of Nations Air Force Aviation Magic Band Luminous Witches. Check that out if you hate Strike Witches. Check that out. Classroom of the Elite second season, or Yokoso Jitsu Ryoko Shinjo Shugi no Kyoshitsu e second season. This one's streaming on Crunchyroll, ran for 12 episodes, done by Studio Lurch. The source is a light novel. The genres are comedy. There was comedy in the show. I'm trying to remember comedy points. Comedy, romance, question mark, school drama. This one, this is the second season, of course. So for those that are not aware, it essentially follows a guy named Ayano Koji, who starts going to this one specific prestigious school, the Kodo Ikusei Senior High School. It's a very interesting school. It's not your normal school. It's basically for like the elite. They come there. It's all about your grades. And each of these school years has like multiple ranks, A through D. And depending on your efforts, you can raise up into the other classes. And of course, the one that's in the A class gets all the funding. And those that are in the D class basically are facing expulsion. So obviously, Ayano Koji gets into the worst class. And so it's up to him to really, seems like it's up to him to really try to help everybody kind of come. Well, he doesn't really. Mostly it's the class itself needs to come together and work together to get their grades up and pass all these different quizzes and competitions in order to, one, not get expelled, but two, get more funding and possibly raise their ranks up higher. So yeah, that's kind of the gist. And I think in the first season, we had a lot of focus on Sudo, Sakura, and then we went into some, like, they went to a secluded island where they had this big competition against each of the classes. And then in the second season, they're coming back. And as they're coming back, they get a little quiz as well on the way back. And then everything really starts to focus in on, they did a like a sports festival kind of thing. And then later on, really kind of coming to a head with one particular character in one of the other classrooms. So your thoughts?
It's a show.
Neither one of us want to talk about this show.
I want to love this show so much. And it's so frustrating because I love it's got a brilliant concept, but one of my biggest issues other than Ayano Koji, which let's just set him aside.
Let's just put that in a box over here.
Yeah, we'll put it in a box. We'll set it on fire, and we'll send it down the street. No, it's one of those that the concept of it is very brilliant. It's setting up this idea of merit in a kind of classroom setting where literally the more you do to further your class, the better your class will do as a whole. The downside is, and this is something that's kind of touched on in the second season, is the idea behind the hands off of the faculty is to encourage this almost subversion aspect, which I do like that idea. I love the concept of.
Even though it picks and chooses when they want to be hands off.
I agree.
And this talked about that beforehand. It was like, thanks for pointing that out, Chris. Yes, that's exactly what frustrates me. Over here, Sudo can't kick a trash can, but over here, somebody can waterboard somebody.
It's
what?
The rules of the system are picked and choosed on when they want to enforce those rules. And I get that it's the student council and all that stuff. I get that. There's a lot of the frustration in this show is that it's not consistent across the board. It relies very heavily on, well, it was Ayano Koji's plan all along.
According to Keikaku.
Keikaku, as Andrew loves to put it. It's really, really frustrating. Too much stuff is done behind the scenes and then just sudden reveal. And I understand the concept that Ayano Koji is super brilliant, and what he's trying to do is be the in the middle guy. I got that, but the problem is that when you do have these sudden reveals, you haven't seen anything, and it's just, well, it was all along. It was set up this way. Well, yeah, but you didn't show the process. And I've had this problem with several shows before.
I think it was most evidence in that that whole segment that he did on the boat on the way back. That's like a prime example of where I get kind of frustrated because, yeah, I guess technically you could, and maybe it's a thing in the light novel, they probably show the rosters with all the characters from what teams went to where for that particular quest or that particular quiz. And you probably could have figured it out, but in this animated adaptation form, obviously, we don't get to see that roster until the end when they go, oh, you could have figured it out if you noticed this. And it's like, well, I didn't get to see this, so I wouldn't have been able to figure this out.
Yeah, they did the thing with the there was that. There was also the sports meet. Randomly, they go, oh, well, Ayano Koji was pulling the strings the whole time. And yeah. It's like, okay, that's all fine and dandy. I'm fine with Ayano Koji doing all these things in the background, but what is he doing? We all we're seeing is the results of it, not the actual process. And I'm okay with a little bit of shadow manipulation. That's fine, but there's also got to be something in the foreword that's a little bit more showing the parts instead of just saying, well, I was in control of the entire thing the whole time. Well, I had already set up this character to do this way back here. I got that, but you're going to have to do a little bit more of the guiding, I guess, because just randomly saying, well, I did it the whole time is not enough. And it is frustrating. And I agree with Andrew. Maybe it's one of those things that maybe if I just go ahead and try and see if the light novel feels a little bit better, maybe I'll enjoy it more. But as it stands right now, I'm frustrated with the show. I really am. I even wanted to give Ayano Koji a lot more leeway because I know the whole thing behind him as a character who is repressed / no emotions, the robot type character, soulless doll.
The lab dude. Well, it says the white room. I don't think it specifies it's a lab, but it's a white room.
I want to give that a lot of leeway, but as it stands right now, I don't care enough to find out, and that's the frustrating thing. But yeah, I'm frustrated with the show as it is.
Yeah, it's technically one of those things where I acknowledge this writer's really good. Like, there's so much clever writing here that I cannot express enough that, like, each of the quizzes technically has a really cool concept to them. What it kind of does to pin each of the classes together against each other, all that stuff is really clever. And I mean, like, even with the whole, I wish I can remember the name of it, but the quiz that they had on the way back from the beach, it was a really cool concept. Unfortunately, with that one, it's like it's just nothing but meeting after meeting after meeting after meeting before, oh, by the way, reveal, it's all done. And it's like, okay, that was the most anticlimactic thing I've ever watched. But you do get a sense during that entire situation, it's Ayano Koji trying to push Horikita forward. And I think everything surrounding the whole story and everything kind of encompassing it is really clever. It's just, it feels so dissatisfying so often. It's difficult to really enjoy it at the same time. I get the writing there. The writing is really, really good. But at the same time, it's not satisfying. And at the end of every kind of arc, I don't feel satisfied. I feel, in a lot of the cases, I feel like I just hate the main character. Like, he's so not likable, and I don't like what he's doing. Now, granted, it's getting into the realms really quickly of something like Overlord, where it's like, you kind of get what they're doing, but at the same time, you don't agree with what they're doing. And with Iona Koji, it's getting even further than like something with Aynes, because all I'm seeing him doing is literally putting people through absolute hell. Like, we had two situations in the season where somebody is literally getting bullied, and again, like I said earlier, a rag thrown on their face and water poured on their face, and it's technically his fault, and he's allowing it because he wants to do something with that person. It's like, I don't like Iona Koji. Like, I understand why he's doing it, because he doesn't understand people. He sees them as tools, but it's not that I'm going to like it. It's not. I understand what they're doing, but I'm not going to like it. And I've gotten to the point at the end of the season where I absolutely despise him. Like, I don't see him in any way, shape, or form redeemable at this point. And I'm granted, it's assumed at this point it's going to be similar to a lot of other stories, like, you know, Mushoku Tensei, where eventually he will suddenly realize that people are more than tools, and you'll suddenly be apologetic for what he's done. But I don't know. I don't know at this point. Well, maybe we'll see in third season. It's already got a third season coming. Maybe that's the point which all comes ahead. Seeing the stuff that certain characters have gone through has really broken my heart. And again, like I said, I see some really good writing here. Like that, and that's, I think, the thing that's always kind of driven me through this series is I acknowledge this writer's really, really good. It's just, I don't know if it's because the source material is unsatisfying in most of the arcs, or if it's just, it's not adapting enough to give me that satisfaction with the anime adaptation.
I would lean more towards it. It just doesn't work on a visual medium in per se. That's the only thing.
I kind of see them having an entire page full of the roster from the first segment of this season. And I can see you possibly, you know, go, oh, yeah, I did notice that. I should have caught that. Dang it. But you don't when you see it at the very end, when everything's according to Kikaku. It was technically a lose point, which is kind of surprising, but still. But no, I'm kind of glad I got a little. Here's my other issue. Like, with the first season, the biggest stain in the first season was Kushida. She was the, what do you want to call it, a Gatmoe or whatever. She is the overly cutesy girl that is suddenly psychotic, and she goes completely from being super cutesy to being stupid, like stupid psychotic. Like, I argued with a lot of people. I wouldn't mind Kushida so much if it wasn't just if it was in the middle. Like, she's not cute bubbly, she's manipulating people, but she's kind of normal when she's not being cute and bubbly. They went complete psychotic with her, and we finally got we had an attempt at explaining her. It wasn't satisfying at all. I was like, wow, somebody it's one of those ones where me and Chris joke about, man, somebody must have died. Like, somebody had to have died. She wants to get rid of Horikta. Somebody had to have died. She knows a secret. Horikta's like, I don't know. I don't know what she's talking about. Literally, Horikta's like, I don't know what the hell this girl's talking about. No, you know what I'm talking about. You know exactly what happened. And it's like, I think the reason that she doesn't remember what happened is because it wasn't that big of a deal. anyways, so yeah, that was, again, unsatisfying. I writer's really great. There's a lot of really good stuff in here. It's just, I think it just comes down to, it's not satisfying. Like, in the end, it's never satisfying for me. Yes, a certain fight scene, which they put a lot of budget into in this season, really fluid fight scene.
That one was enough. Cool. That was a cool fight.
It was a cool fight, but it wasn't enough for me. I it was a little bit satisfying in what it kind of did with Ryuin, but again, in the end, after I realized that the teacher literally did nothing, it's not satisfying. It doesn't make any sense to me, but yeah, it's just the rules of the school. So obviously it works out. But we'll see. We'll see with third season. I'm going to watch third season, because like I said, there's good writing in here. I want to see it. It's just, I wish it was more satisfying for me. So we'll see. Classroom Elite, second season. Check that out if that sounds good to you. Moving on, Orient Part 2. Orient Awajima. Awajishima. Geki to Hin. This one is streaming on Crunchyroll. Ran for 12 episodes. The studio is ACGT, source of manga, of course by the creator of Maji, which is Shinobu Otaka. The director for the series is Tatsuya Yanagisawa, who did High School DxD. And yeah, I think if I remember correctly, the series opens up in Japan where Oni suddenly show up, and they pretty much have this big war between the Bushi and the Oni. Eventually, the Oni pretty much overtook the entire area. And over time, they create a lot of little mining villages where people mine up ores to feed the Onis. And the Oni start to pretty much re-educate them all to believe that the Bushi were evil and that they made the war last so long and it caused so much issues with the world because they didn't accept the Onis. And we follow Musashi and Kojiro, who are working at one of these mining places, and eventually kind of learn about Kojiro's, was his grandfather or his father? I think it was his father, who basically taught them about the Bushi. And eventually the two of them decide to rise up against the Oni and travel together as a team of Bushi and take on the Oni. And eventually they run to other groups. I think when they pretty much open up this part, we had just met Michiru, and they were going off to this one meeting of all these Bushi, the main head Bushis, and they were going to go off to fight one of these. Essentially, they have kind of a tree system with the Oni where you have the main Oni, the one that kind of created them all, and that branches off to like these generals, so to speak, and then those branch off to these other powerful Oni. And so they're kind of going for one of those, not the upper one, but one of the main key ones. Because I think didn't they insinuate that if you take out that one, it'll kind of destroy the rest of them underneath them or something like that?
I don't remember that. But
they're going for one of the main dogs. And that's kind of where
it was more to liberate this island for this other group.
Yeah. So what'd you think of this part? Because I got like six episodes in and I kind of just gave up. Like I just keep forcing myself and I'm like, I just need to stop.
It's one of those that I'm watching the first season. I wanted to get into the second season more because it felt like
part two, Chris. Gosh,
we were
season two.
We were just getting into, you know, starting to scratch the surface and really open up the world. And in a way, the second part did give us that aspect of really starting to dig into the world and try and give us something to work with. We got a reveal of a fifth kind of color, for lack of a better term. We also started to really kind of delve into the mindset of the quote unquote evil faction. I thought they were more of a neutral faction, but apparently they're leaning more towards the evil. So yeah, we got a lot of those things going on. So it was really interesting to see a lot of that stuff for sure. But when it all said and done, I came away going, yeah, it's one of those snack type shows. I'm not getting a lot out of this show, where most of your shonens, you feel almost hyped to get into the next episode. I've never really felt that way with this show. And that is one of the biggest frustrations that I have with this is not really feeling like I've got to keep going. I got to keep going. I mean, it says a lot that Andrew just said, I'm not going to torture myself with this. I almost agree. I wanted to keep going because I'm waiting for that moment of, man, this is a really awesome show. I mean, none of the nothing is really kind of dragging me through. So it's all in all, it's good. I'm fine with it, but it's not fantastic that I feel like I got to keep going. Fairy Tail, I kept wanting to go. A lot of these other shows, I keep wanting to go. This one is like, yeah, it's there.
And the sad thing is, like, going into the second season of it, it was like, I think with the first, here, make me say it now, with the first part of Orient, I think the thing that kind of grabbed me was Tsugumi and her Bushi band. I thought it was kind of a cool concept to kind of reveal that, yeah, not all Bushi bands are good. Like, there's some people that will use the power of a Bushi band to control people and ultimately to sacrifice them for the betterment of themselves. And I think you got that concept with her. And then we get into the whole aspect of the different swords and how Musashi obviously has to be special somehow and have a special sword. but getting everybody getting their weapon and all that kind of stuff. And then getting into the second part, the thing that I found was that I didn't get that thing I'm looking for, that hook. You can't go two whole cores without getting a hook. I wasn't getting it even into the second core. Instead, what I was getting is introducing character, show how Musashi's dumb, show how they're much more better than Musashi, and Musashi needs to learn this ability. And here's all these basics of all Bushis know, and Musashi doesn't know any of this stuff. So obviously Musashi's useless. Introduce character, and all being kind of pulled together by just not good or derelict of animation that you can typically get from a very standard shonen anymore. Like, I have argued before this idea of the death of the old shonen, where you have these new shonens coming out that are all either decently or really incredibly animated, and this is one of those shonens where it's like, are we even trying to make things move? We are some, like, bare basic animation here. We're not even trying to make things move. It's not like you're a long-running shonen where you have to pump out an episode every single week for an entire year. This is your second core, and you're still not moving decently. They weren't moving decently from the first two episodes, so it doesn't have anything that's it's pulling me. And like, I'm not getting a hook. I'm not the characters are not that great, and I'm just getting nothing but just a pile on of so many introductions of characters that I'm not getting much out of each individual one of them. If you're introducing a character every single episode, you're not even getting into them, I'm not going to get anything out of these characters that you're introducing. So, I don't know. It's just, I want something to be there, but it's not there. So I gave up. Like, I'm like, I just need to get to that hook. And it's like, it's not, if we're 18 episodes in at that point that I was at, it's like, no, it's not going to get to it. So as much as I just need to go watch Magi.
Yeah, you do.
Like, the only reason I was watching this is because it's Magi creator. I love their character designs. I really do. I think it's got a very cool, unique style to all their characters and the outfits and stuff. But no. Just no. But yeah, that's Orient Part 2. Check that out if that's interesting to you. Moving on. Overlord Season 4. Four seasons now. We're on Crunchyroll. Ran for 13 episodes. Done by Studio Madhouse. Source of the light novels. Genres are action, adventure, fantasy, game, magic, supernatural. For those that are unfamiliar with this series, essentially follows a guy who was playing a video game, had a big guild with all of his friends, and they had this big Tome of Nazarick, which had all these NPC guards in it and stuff. They were kind of like villainous looking. All their characters were kind of different, you know, bad guy looking characters, including the main character. He has this big, huge skeletal lich character that he was playing as. He was going to stay online until the servers went down because the game's shutting down, and he finds himself not being logged out. He's actually stuck in the world, so he starts early on. It was like him going out, trying to figure out what happened and if his friends are there. And then it got into him trying to get skills, unique skills, and just trying to find unique things in the world. Eventually catching the attention of the world itself. They try to infiltrate his tome. They all got wrecked. And then he kind of gets more and more involved with the overall world and the other kingdoms, eventually taking down some of them. And pretty much in the fourth season, it's really him kind of deciding at this point that he just wants to, you know, take over the world itself and send out adventurers to find unique things in the world itself, and eventually butting heads with certain groups, pulling a lot of strings in the background. So, yeah, your thoughts on three, season four?
really, the first few episodes were really rough. I had a really hard time getting through those first few episodes, but it's understandable. There was a lot of setup going on into this next section that they were getting into. The
first episode was good. It was the dragon stuff and the dwarves.
The dragon stuff I could have done without, but at the same time, I do like that they were trying to do a little bit of more digging into the dwarves and all that stuff. So, it's fine where it was, but that
from understanding, definitely that from what people are saying, what I'm saying is there's a couple of aspects of what we're currently seeing that was supposed to be in the movie that's not out yet. So they kind of did a Hero Academia. I'm not sure exactly the full details because I didn't want to read too much into it, but a lot of people are saying that there's technically some context to what's going on right now in the movies, which, please, Japan, stop releasing movies after series that gives context to stuff before. They do that with My Hero Academia. Don't do it. Stop. Just stop. Sorry.
The going into the aspect as a whole of going into the ultimate climax of this particular section, I really, really did like. I loved the aspect of the showing the final result of our princess and a lot of the stuff involved in that kingdom. I really thought that that was really interesting how they played a lot of that out. The setting up Shaltir as kind of a go-to and getting almost bringing in the flies, for lack of a better term, and getting them all set up to where the ultimate result of a conflict that would cause Mamung or to cause Ainz to come against this country. I liked a lot of that. I thought that was brilliant, and I love this ultimate look what I did to your favorite Disney princess. So yeah, loved it. Great season for sure.
Yeah, I think I made a whole video on this. Season four is everything I love and hate about Overlord. Because I love Overlord because I love the characters. I think every single NPC, quote unquote, that's in Nazarick is just amazing. Seeing more Shaltir is fantastic. I even love Kakutas, Demiurge, Albedo. There's so many fantastic characters. We didn't see Suwade. I just realized that. We even seen a Womp Girl. We have a Womp Girl. It was a Womp Girl was with Albedo's sister. So that was like I don't think we ever seen Albedo's sister before.
No.
So yeah, that was a little bit interesting. She looked terrifying, but at the same time, she seemed like she's the only person that cares about things. It's a little bit of that was a little bit of subverting expectations. But no, I think overall, I love all of these characters. I think the whole, it's the art style and just the cleverness of how they just have this sense of being overpowered, but at the same time, obsessed with Ainz at the same time. It's all good. The thing that frustrates me, and it continues to frustrate me about this series, and I accept it, and it's never that it's bad. It's just it does frustrate me a little bit, is that I always feel like so much time in this series is always given to these side characters that they get into them. They develop them for some of these characters for four whole seasons. You get developments and scenes with them, and you keep showing how they're progressing and they're pushing themselves forward, and then they just get one shot by Ainz and his team. And it's like, why do we even bother showing these characters for this long? And then their story's over. Like it's kind of frustrating because it feels like I've wasted so much time watching these characters and they don't really amount to anything in the end. Now, a lot of them will interweave with other characters to push other characters forward in the overall grand scheme of the story. I understand that, but I can't help but feel like disappointed in the end when I don't really get a real payoff. Now, granted, it always turns into something cool in the end, like not specifying who it is, but you have this point in which one of Ainz's guys comes into this village and one-shots somebody. But then they have the, you know, that forethought to not just walk past them and say, well, it was that easy. It was always this kind of thing of, okay, well, to honor them, I'm going to go down this road. And it's like that, always that kind of like, okay, that was a payoff. Like, I had a payoff for it. But it's still, in the end, when I look back, it's kind of frustrating that this writer just gets so into these side characters, and in the end, they're one shot. Nobody can really stand up against Ainz. I would be really shocked if we ever get to a point where even Ainz's NPCs, Albedo or Shaltir or something, ever find something that they can't stand up against. I think the only sense we really got from was essentially having a doppelganger of Momonga, Fandor actor, not able to stand up against somebody, but he's just a doppelganger. He doesn't really have much power. So I don't know, but I still love the writing. I still love the world. I love the characters. All that stuff is still fascinating. And again, I just eat up the art style of this series, and I can't wait for more. Sadly, I hope we don't have as long as a wait as we did last time, because I think this last time was like 5 years since the last season. Hopefully, I don't get a long wait again. It looks like they did a little better on the CGI this time around. It wasn't as terrible as last season, so that's a big plus. But, yeah, I'm always interested in seeing more. It's definitely a series that I do eventually want to get into the light novel, put past, like, five other things that I need to read through still. But I would love to eventually get into the light novel, because it feels like there is a lot still kind of being missed in the series. I heard a lot of people comment that there was one particular arc that was completely skipped. But I think there's a lot of context on the outer end that maybe you get into with the light novel. Maybe certain characters, I feel like they're anticlimactic with them being removed from the scene. Maybe there is more significance they have in the story that I'm just missing in the adaptation. But yeah, it's still good. Still love the series as a whole. just I have my frustrations. Somebody commented on my video when I was talking about the idea of, you know, characters coming in, building them up, and then having them one be in one shot, and it's like, oh, that's subverting your expectation. Like, at this point, it's not subverting expectations, because I expect that every character that's not a part of Among Us team is going to get one shot at some point. Every single one of them. So, yeah. We'll see. But I'm really hopeful for another season, and I cannot get enough of the series. It's fantastic. I've always loved, from the very beginning, the slow downhill, not really downhill spiral, but the realization at some point that Aynes is becoming the Lich, and he doesn't feel things, and he doesn't regret even brutal actions that he's doing. He's a player isekai into world, becoming the heartless lich that he is. And it's so funny every now and then seeing him kind of get a little bit of his old self into his system, and he gets excited or something, but then this like spell activates and it calms him back down. Like, you need to be like the Lich. You need to keep yourself as your character. That's always been fascinating to me. And I wish it would kind of, it's been a long time since he ever really acknowledged it. And so I'm curious if he'll ever kind of acknowledge that again. It was something that he kind of acknowledged during this whole situation with this village, like in the first season. And I don't think he's really technically acknowledged it since then. He just does these really terrible things, and it never acknowledges that he sees them as NPCs, or it never acknowledges that he just doesn't care. But it would be cool. Maybe that's something that's just kind of lost with the adaptation. Maybe it is inner dialogue that's skipped, but that's another thing I'd be interested to see if it's in the light novel. So but yeah, some really cool action scenes too. I think his fight in the arena was just, that was incredible. That was really good animation. Nothing really beyond that though. But yeah, the dragon stuff was dumb. I understand that the dwarf stuff. The dwarf stuff's important because he's obviously wanting to get Runesmiths. It's kind of a lost arc. So obviously that's important. And yeah, evil Disney princess, which was easily probably the icing on the cake for everybody for this season.
Love the idea of look what I did to your favorite Disney princess. I love it.
I don't think they were saying screw you Disney, we're doing this. It was more of a just
no, just what the fandom. I took your Disney princess and I ruined her.
No, the fandom's like, yes. I don't think anybody wanted a Disney princess. But yeah, Autaxi in the Woods. This is a movie. I did a video on this on my YouTube channel, but I want to make sure that people got my perspective on it on the podcast. For those that don't watch my videos, shame on you. I don't want to get too into the woods. Get what I did there on this movie, but I did kind of want to give, it's more just kind of talk about a warning, so to speak. For those that don't know, Autaxi is an incredible series. 10 out of 10. I absolutely love it. It's gone down as one of my favorite anime of all time. It is an incredible series. For those that don't know, it basically follows a taxi driver named Otakawa, and he drives around in his taxi. He picks up people, takes them to where they need to go. Simple enough. But the idea here is that this writer and the studio in general, because this is an original, they breathe life into a living, breathing city that I think is absolutely incredible and fantastic. So many characters that all live within this bustling city that all seem to, their stories are their own separate stories. Everybody has their own problems they're dealing with. You have this one thug named Dobu. He does criminal acts. You have this group of idols. You have Otakawa's friend. You have these two police officers and their brothers. One is a crooked cop. The other one's a good cop. You have the doctor that looks after Otakawa. You have all these characters, and seemingly what happens is all their stories intertwine in some way. One of the main vehicles, again, pun intended, is Otakawa's taxi. Their stories kind of intertwine because they all have this one point, which they'll probably get into Otakawa's taxi and maybe talk about something, leave something behind the taxi accidentally, that kind of stuff. But it somehow interweaves all these characters. And to see how this writer and these creators interweave those stories in the most brilliant way possible all led up to this amazing climactic end that was, it was genius. Like, again, I cannot express enough, go watch Autaxi. It is a brilliant series through and through. Incredible. Now, Autaxi in the Woods. This is a movie they created, pretty much immediately announced they were going to do it, said that they were going to be doing a movie. They even at that point said this will be a retelling of the series plus extras. And so I came into it fully expecting that probably 99% of it's probably just going to be nothing but recap. But I was expecting at the end of it, it would have a nugget, an answer to something that we did not get answered in the TV series. They had a little bit of cliffhanger at the end of the first season, or the season. They answered it in the cast scroll. Here's my problem with the movie. It sucks. Don't go watch it. If you have never watched Odd Taxi, do not watch the movie. Please, for the love of all that is good, do not watch that movie. If you want to watch that movie, watch the series first. And then if you really want to watch it, go watch it. But do not consume the story through the movie. The movie was a terrible way of presenting the story. Because what they essentially did is, yes, they recapped all the story. But what they did is they went it from a perspective of this group, unknown group, was interviewing different people of the story, and they were telling their side of the story to tell the overall story. And the problem that comes from that is that you're telling the story out of order, plus you're also having people tell the story of other people's perspectives, which doesn't make any sense whatsoever. It's almost as if they're trying to connect these two stories together, so they're saying what this other person did, and it's like they wouldn't know that. Through and through, it's a terrible rendition. I actually was confused watching the movie because I didn't understand what there was a part of me that was trying to recall a lot of the happenings of the series through the movie, and it was started confusing me, and I had to go, no, that's not technically how that should be told. It was confusing me. I understood the story from the original series. The movie was confusing me. That's pretty bad. Through and through, the movie sucks. It's a terrible way of telling the story, and it was satisfying in the end to get an answer to the question that we all had that watched the series, but it annoys me that it was literally answered with, you know how you usually, whenever you watch a movie or a TV series too, you'll have the cast scroll on one side and then they'll have like little stills on the right side that show like some after story. That's where we all have our answers, is still shots on the side for brief seconds. I was so frustrated. So just watch the TV series, please, for the love of this series, watch the TV series. And then, again, if you want that answer to the question at the end of the movie or the TV series, skip to the end credits of the movie, get your answer, and move on with your life. I think the most frustrating thing about this movie's existence is one of the only problems I had with the original series.
This was supposed to be 2 minutes.
Yeah. one of the original things that was the only issue that I really had with the original series was that there was this side story that technically leads up to the cliffhanger of the original series. And it was involving this pin. And you get the answers of, you get that side story by the radio. They had a radio drama. You can go find the transcripts of the radio drama so you can read it. It's really fascinating. And it really does give you a full picture as to what's happening behind the scenes before the very end. And they could have easily just done the original TV series in a more movie format while having every now and then show that context and then wrap it up with the ending that we wanted, the answer of the ending that we wanted, not the ending that we wanted. But instead they chose to do this, and it's terrible. Don't watch the movie, please. Anyways, that's my thoughts on Odd Taxi in the Woods. Don't watch it. Watch the TV series, please. It's an amazing series. 10 out of 10. But yeah, that's it for this parter of the summer 2022 anime season reviews. We still have Made in Abyss, Danmachi, Summertime Render, Devil's a Part-Timer 2, Call the Night. The Maid I Hire recently is unusual. The Maid I Hire recently is mysterious, right? Mysterious. Ayashi.
Yes, Ayashi.
A couple of cuckoos.
If you don't know Ayashi after finishing Ayashi. That show.
Ayashi! a couple of cuckoos. I hate that show. Apparently Hanabi-chan.
Yes.
I quit heroing the OVA, Afret the OVA, Tokyo Mew Mew New, Kakaguri Twin, Utawara Mono. We'll do some mid-season reviews of Utawara Mono, the Mask of Truth, and Biscuit Hammer, if I get back to that one. So anyways, Hope you guys enjoyed this review. If you did, again, make sure to share that out to your friends. Support us on Patreon, our tips link, and our super thanks buttons. We have all the links at otakuspirit.com. Definitely appreciate you guys' support and for checking us out. Hope you guys enjoy these reviews. And you all take care.
Oos!
My wife, 2 feeling.